Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today we have Jim Curry. Jim is the co-founder and CEO of Build Group. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. I'm really excited to be here.
Likewise. All right, so why don't we start with Build Group? Would love to know the investment thesis and what you're focused on.
Yeah, you know, I started Build Group with my partner Lanham coming out of Rackspace almost 10 years ago. And, you know, what we were trying to do at the time was take all the good things and bad things that we had learned by being operators that were in a venture-backed company and figure out how to do a better job or what we thought would be a better job. And also really leverage our strengths, right? We're operators. I don't think of myself as an investor. I still don't. And what I mean by that, I think investors are really good at optimizing the entry and the terms and the exit, but not necessarily great in between. I would say I'm the opposite. I'm really good in between, and you know, entry and exit are probably not my ideal strengths. And so we wanted to make sure we were in a position to really leverage those strengths. So the basic thesis was we wanted to run a relatively concentrated portfolio where the partners would be able to actually engage in the companies to help, right? And when I say help, I don't mean just give them references to customers or other VCs, but I mean really dig in and help them deal with problems and work through that, which is really hard to do if you spend a substantial part of your time sourcing and building out the firm. Second thing we really want to do is bring a growth mindset, a long-term growth mindset to the companies we work with. And we did that by structuring this as a permanent fund. So the first fund we raised, $330 million, it's structured as a permanent fund, which essentially means we can hold investments for as long as they want to go. And it allows us to go in with the companies and help them focus on long-term value creation. My big belief, I'm a product background, my big belief is that whether you're intending to sell in 2 years or 20, you're best served by having a long-term plan and strategy, because that, even if you don't deliver on it, having the vision for it will help to create an excellent outcome for you if you end up wanting to sell the company. But I always want to make sure in our companies, you're going to have a mixture of folks. You'll have folks that are much more focused on the short-term growth, and those that are focused on long-term, we fit that long-term category. From a product thesis, we really are focused on, initially in our first fund, the way we described it was data-enabled workflow SaaS companies. So if you go back to when we actually raised our first money in 2018, SaaS was something that investors have been doing for a really long time. Workflow SaaS is popular because it's super sticky. When you have an app that a human or a machine depends on for their job, it's something that's easy to grow. There's a lot of land and expand opportunities typically. But what I was really fascinated with was the early days of data science. Folks were trying to figure out what to do with the data in these workflow apps. And many people were pursuing the strategy that Salesforce had, which is, how do I provide my data to other apps and build a network? And that is certainly an important way to think about using the data. But I became really fascinated by this idea of how do you take the data from the workflow and actually make the product better? How do you take it from an app that you log into and you're guided through what to do to an app where you log in and it says, hey, here are the three things you should be doing, or here are the things I'm doing on your behalf. And that became the area in which we worked. Fast forward to sort of 2020, 2021, that just happened to work really well in the world of AI. And in full transparency, if you go back to our original deck, we talked about AI, but I said it's probably a decade or more away. But when you have a company that's already prepared for it and you can put AI on top of it, it works really well. And so we describe it now as AI-enabled workflow investing. We've had a number of exits that have been in this space, and that's where we spend our time.
Great. A whole bunch of questions. Let's start with working with the founders. Curious whether or not you find that there's a reoccurring theme and assistance that you guys provide?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I tell people, don't overthink this one too much, right? So in the end, when you're in running a business, you can be really myopic. Your head's down, you got to deal with the day-to-day. But one of the luxuries of being a VC, I shouldn't say luxury, as an ex-operator, this actually drives me crazy. I don't have to deal with the day-to-day. I have really long feedback cycles. but I don't wake up at 6 a.m. in the morning, email box full, upset customers, data centers down, all that kind of stuff. It's a different world to be in. And I think one of the advantages, especially being an operator advisor from the outside, is I can help them take a step back and remember what they're trying to do. The number one thing that I think we do right that really helps companies is we help them define their strategy every year. And I tell them, don't have to do a lot of work on this. It can be a 1 to 5 page document, but write your strategy down. You should know exactly what you're trying to do. Why is that important? Well, you need to communicate with your management team what the strategy is, and you need to align on it. And you need to align your board around that. The second thing you need to do is create an operating plan from it. Well, you can't create an operating plan without a strategy, and you should make sure that everything in your operating plan matches your strategy. And then the next piece is the budget. Are you actually spending money to support the operating plan that supports the strategy? And then as the year goes along, you'll have people send you ideas. Board members, I'm notorious for this. You send all kinds of stuff. And what you want to have is kind of a core document that you look at and say, hey, is this fitting with the strategy or if it doesn't? And I know I've done a good job when I get a note back from, because I forward stuff along, and a CEO will say to me, hey, Jim, this is a really great idea. I'm attaching our strategy document. It doesn't appear to fit in there. Are you proposing a change to our strategy? Or do you think that this is not the right thing to do? So I think helping them stay with that focus is a really big thing. And do that. And also trying to get them at the stage we invest. So one thing I neglected to mention, we invest the early growth stage. So these are companies that are, call it 3 to 5 million ARR on the low end, 10 million on the high end. They're very immature in their processes. So part of the strategy to operating plan to budget is starting to help them figure out how to operationalize this and really build it. And that's where we really excel. I think we're really good at helping them put kind of the scale in place to build a long-term business.
Oh, you're in my mind. That was going to be one of my next questions. But you gave me another thought. So tangentially, I'd love to know your opinion, if you have one, on single founder or co-founders from a success perspective.
Oh, that is a great question. I'll answer a little bit of a different question first. I do not believe in co-CEOs. That is a really difficult thing to make work. In the end, you really need to have one person in charge. I do think there are lots of examples where co-founders work, and I think there's examples where they don't work. In general, what I've seen is when you have a technical co-founder and a more market, go-to-market oriented co-founder, those tend to work pretty well. When you have two of the same type, it can cause problems. So if you think about this, if you have two engineers, or if you have two sort of go-to-market folks, their expertise is very similar. And unless they're perfectly aligned, you can get real gaps in place. But I'm also a big believer, when it comes to what I do now, I believe that in general, having more people sharpen the sword is important. I think it's good to have ideas batted around. But in the end, when it comes to execution, you need to have an ability for one person to make the call.
Fantastic. It makes good sense. You know, I've seen it both ways. I think your point about having complementary skill sets is invaluable. Especially too, I see a lot of questions around non-technical founders saying, hey, how do I bring this to life? I was like, well, other very successful companies out there who've answered the same question by bringing somebody on the cap table who's going to roll up their sleeves and put in some blood, sweat, and tears and bring something to life. So a great, great feedback and insight. I agree. You started touching on stage, and I know there's a big focus on data-enabled SaaS. Do you find, though, that you end up in certain verticals over some rather than others?
Yeah, initially, I'll tell you kind of the Fund One story. I looked for areas in which there was complexity in terms of the number of operators. That by itself seemed to generate data. So think supply chain manufacturers. Okay. You tend to, when you have more players, you have more data. That data needs to be shared. That data tends to be valuable. That's the case. But then one of our bigger successes, we had a company called Casetext, which was in the legal space, which, you know, when I invested in that 5 years ago, I remember everyone saying, what are you doing? Legal tech's kind of a dead hole. And this was even different because it was trying to be on the front end. They were trying to build a very early version of an AI-enabled drafting tool. Mm-hmm. And the founder just sold me when I met with him, and he couldn't raise any money. But it was interesting at the time. I never really thought about it as a data space. But then he showed me, hey, lawyers have been using our platform for 8 years to research and generate briefs. And I have tons of data on how they do that. And now I'm going to go and optimize it. So I learned that kind of data is everywhere. I initially was looking for segments, but to me, honestly, the world of SaaS is full of opportunities in this space. I think the great part is now it's much easier in the world of AI to extract data. And the data science world, it was a lot harder, right? I mean, you think about the way you had to structure data the right way. You had to make sure you collected it the right way. You had to have someone that knew how to build the artifacts. You had to have a business analyst looked at it. I mean,
Sure.
now, like, it doesn't take that much work. I showed my kids how you just dump a bunch of data from MLB into ChatGPT, and it can do a lot of analysis for you. And so the world has changed, and I think it makes it a lot easier for people to do. But, you know, I don't necessarily have a thesis around verticals, but I do think there are some that probably will have more opportunity. But in general, I think every SaaS company has an opportunity to do this.
Yeah, it's interesting. It'd be fun to unpack whether or not the opportunities correlated to the complexity. If I had to bet,
Yeah.
I'd probably say yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. We're doing it ourselves. We like every other firm, we're figuring out how to use AI to really work top of funnel, ingest, extract data, move the analysis. But I'm also using it to analyze our investment process. Where are we having gaps? Where is it slowing down? And it's not a super complex process, right? We're a small team. We're only 8 people. But I do think there's value into measuring, you know, what we're doing well and what we're not. Not just measured on the outcomes of the investments, but how's the process flow, and where we have inconsistencies. And that includes how we due diligence, everything else. So yeah, I do think that the more players you see in an industry, the more those players have to work together, the more you're going to tend to find data. Because when you have partners, you're sharing data, which means you probably have applications that are generating really valuable data.
Totally makes sense. If we could take a step back for a moment. So I heard Fund started in 2018. Would love to know what your career looked like leading up to co-founding Bill Group.
Sort of a meandering road. So, you know, I went to UT as an undergrad, and I was sort of perfect on paper. My guess is you were probably perfect on paper too, right? I was well-rounded at everything. I had great scores, and I had kind of a holy crap moment my senior year. I don't know what I want to do with my life. I got a job at Goldman. In investment banking. And for me, that was, I'm the son of a NASA engineer and a school teacher. You
Oh.
know, I didn't have a lot of experience with business. And I was like, well, this is just a great way to learn business. I was an econ major. I thought investment banking would be great because of the math. Turns out investment banking math is not that hard. It ended up being a great experience because I had great training. This was back when these programs were really small, but Goldman prided itself on almost an apprenticeship type program. And I had some amazing people that literally sat next to me. Amy Hood, who's the current CFO of Microsoft, was my cube mate and
Oh.
good friend. And I learned a ton from all these folks. And I left from there to go work at a private equity fund that attracted me because I started to get the itch of, like, maybe I don't want to do this. I don't want to make money by taxing other people's transactions with a fee. Maybe I want to do something different. And the founder of the firm promised me an opportunity to go work at a company. And so second year, I went to work at a company in Edmonton, Alberta. Was the day after I actually got engaged, and had to explain to my wife I was going to leave, and I loved it. I did everything, and I loved the company, and that led me to switch careers. I helped start a company called Bow Street in Boston back in the dot-com days. You could think of us as sort of you know, for lack of a better term, we were an app server for web services. We had a great little run before the dot-com crash, and then we went under. We had raised $130 million. I had done sales for us. I was running sales for our financial services vertical, and learned a lot in that process. And then I had to watch it all dry up, and ended up going to Dell for a couple years, and then found Rackspace right as it was getting off the ground. My partner called me and said, "Come down and join." We went from there. And Rackspace was a fabulous ride. I don't know how much you know about the history of the company, but we were early player in the web hosting place. We transitioned to a cloud computing company, and we grew it to $2 billion in revenue, $10 billion market cap before it got sold to Apollo. And I worked on a number of things there, in particular around the product area. And one of the things I did in the middle of that, which was a really kind of seminal experience for me, was I started and ran a project called OpenStack, which is an open source project, which now is called Open Infrastructure Project and is just merged with Linux. It is the most, in terms of code written, it's second most behind Linux. And if you run a private cloud deployment today in the world, it's probably running on OpenStack. The reason I was really intrigued by this was, and kind of 2008, 2009, the writing was on the wall that Amazon was gonna kill us. I mean, they all of a sudden hosting was going from a data center infrastructure game, put up servers, put up, you know, networking, get it all up and going, to a software game. And we weren't necessarily going to win that, nor could we compete with them based on costs. So the idea was, let's get the rest of the world that has the same problem as us aligned with us to build this code base. So I started that project. I ran it for a bit as a foundation. And it really helped me kind of understand what, I mean, obviously going through the dot-com era, that was a big tectonic shift, moving over to, you know, kind of from the client server world to that world. But this was a really big shift. From, you know, enterprise software went from being something that was all proprietary to a real focus on open source. And I watched that shift up close. And I think we're seeing a lot of the same things happen right now with AI as it comes in and changes models. So that was my background. I left in 2015 and started Build Group shortly after with my partner. We invested our own money for a bit. You know, one lesson you learn in this industry is you can lose your own money as much time as you want. You can lose other people's money one time. Then you're done, right? And I'm also very conscientious, right? I wanted to do a good job. And so we had to learn how to do this, how to get in a position we felt confident we could raise a fund and not do a terrible job at it. And so we did that. We raised money in 2018. That fund is a permanent fund, so it'll be around forever. It's got recycling built into it. And we're continuing to evolve how we go forward in the future with new offerings.
Fantastic. So you have this fantastic operator and technical experience and technical background. How does that influence your due diligence today when you're looking at the potential investment?
Yeah, you know, from a technical perspective, I've learned this the hard way. One of the things you learn as an operator who goes to become a VC is you don't quickly reject things, right? So VCs, especially who have not been operators, they're looking for stuff that's perfect, right? They want to find stuff that they don't feel like they're going to have to engage in because they've got 30 portfolio companies. They just need them to work. And if they're not working, they can't really spend a lot of time on them. I had a little bit of a different approach, which is not the right approach. And I've since learned it's more common than I thought, which is I looked at things and would say, I could fix that. Now, what I've learned is when it comes to business models, that is somewhat true. Like, I feel like almost anything that you can find that's not working well on the operating side is fixable. That's not 100% true, but you know, I would tell people every single company I've invested in has had some major go-to-market issue that needed adjusting. But what is really hard to fix is product. What I won't do is get in a situation where a product is busted. And early on, because I am more product-oriented, I was much more excited about the idea of dealing with products that might have some issues. Why is that? Well, you didn't have to pay as much for the company. I feel like I could fix it. Broken products are just really, I shouldn't say broken, sub-optimized products is a better word. But that's one thing I've learned. The diligence side, you know, is interesting. I think our diligence tends to be much more PE-like than VC-like, which can be dangerous because the data, if you take the data for the companies this small and make too many assumptions, you can make bad decisions. And we have both ways. We've analyzed our way out of good investments. We've analyzed our way into bad investments. It's just how it goes when you look at data. But we have what we've gotten really good at now is how to do diligence in a way that's not just about where the company is today, but really helping to establish where it can go in the future. And I really use this as an opportunity to build a relationship with the folks that we're going to work with, not just the CEO, but the whole company. And to me, that's really important. And it's not a matter of often hear VCs refer to whether founders are coachable or not. I found that kind of offensive because I view this as a joint journey. And that to me, the question is, are we going to work well together and make each other better through our engagement or not? And that's where I spend most of my time in the diligence. And I would say now what comes out of our diligence phase is much more of like an operating plan than it is a diligence checklist.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so then approach is unique. You know, you're right. I mean, you regularly hear about you know, fund investors who, you know, their mentality is, well, it's a numbers game. Let me cut a bunch of checks, but by consequence, you know, I can't get involved as I'd otherwise like. So then, as you look back since 2018, what were some of the key takeaways of how Build Group evolved and how you run the business today as a consequence of how you look for companies and invest?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because you know, Build Group itself is a firm, right? And so we had to think about how we evolved this business. And we initially took a, you know, a very company approach to it from the very beginning. So, you know, the way to think about it is a lot of other firms will hire staff and they're not really specialized. So if you think about investment staff, they find deals, source them, close them, serve on the board, et cetera. We specialized. And so I got a team to really work top of funnel. I got investment folks to work more, kind of more mid-funnel, analyze. And then most of the work that's done after the fact is done by the partners on the team or out of our network, because that's where our strengths really are. And I think that model works really well. Now, there's changes you have to do to it because I've never managed investment professionals before. And investment professionals, especially young ones, have to think through how they where their career is going. And specialization is a really hard thing for them to understand. But what I've gotten better at doing is recognizing, hey, I want specialization, but I also want to broaden their skill set. So I spend time trying to move them into different parts of the organization. If someone has got a background as an investment banker and really good at analysts, but and they want to learn how to source deals, which to me is really a lot of selling, I move them over there. And I say, well, we're going to learn how to do sales now. We've also had real success in people off our team. And I think we attract people onto our team that have an itch to operate, like I did early in my career, and I didn't know it. And so we've had three people spin out and go to portfolio companies to work. And I love that. I mean, to me, I celebrate that all day long. And so we've done that. I think when I look at our investment process, as I said, we've evolved now from to something that looks more like an operating plan. I also think we've gotten better at understanding the art of investing. And what I mean by that is if I were early on much more scientific in how I approach this and it was sort of more black and white, I now recognize there's much more art to it in terms of the people, in terms of the opportunity and how to think about it. And I think in that there's real opportunity. Casetext is a great example on that because on paper, when we invested in it, it wasn't exactly the perfect company. But I met the founder. He, one of the first people I'd seen that actually had developed an AI team. And I got really fascinated with what they were doing. So I would say I'm getting a better judge of kind of the softer side of this business than I was to begin with. But that only comes from experience. And then the last thing I'd say is I like people, right? You know, one of the things about being an operator, I like teams. I like building with people. Having a strong relationship is really important. Strong relationship where you're trusted is important. And so for me, I want to be in a position where whether it be the CEO, their head of product or sales, they want to call me. Not because they're obligated to, because they've got a monthly call schedule with me, because they want to celebrate, they want help with the problem, they just want to talk, right?
Yeah.
You know, I like to think of them as good friends. And you know, it doesn't mean you don't have tough conversations. I mean, you know, sure. As I always remind them, like, I'm in a fiduciary, you're a fiduciary. In the end, the success of this company is more important than either one of us. And we got to work through it. But I enjoy business. I enjoy the people that do business. I like working through problems and I learn a ton. You know, this is my point about why I don't like the term coachable founders. I learn as much from them as they learn from me.
Right.
And if you're doing it really well, working together, you can achieve a much better outcome than on your own. One other thing I'll say about our model that I think is unique and really resonates with founders is I don't know if you're familiar with the power law outcome of venture capital, which basically says, you know, you have one or two portfolio companies that really account for all your returns. Most of the rest are zeros, right? Think about that if you're a founder, right? Think of you also if you're one of those zeros. I mean, that's your career, that's your company, that's your money. And you don't want to be written off. And yeah. I don't think that way. As I tell founders, I go, my portfolio is concentrated enough. I don't want zero. I need something that works. And I actually care and I want this thing to be successful. So I think that alignment really does matter as well.
It makes total sense. And I love what you said about, you know, kind of developing a relation to the point where you can be personable, I tell you it's underrated. Especially given how busy we can be, and I think maybe sometimes founders could be intimidated by their investors, not always. So kudos to you for really making yourself or at least establishing a relationship where you can have conversations like this, because they're invaluable. Right.
Yeah.
The benefit of looking at lots of different businesses, where sometimes, founders, this could be their first or second rodeo. Yeah. We'd love to get your take on culture. Have you found it's just been a natural extension of your business and investment philosophy, or are you deliberate?
I think culture is really important. If you look at Rackspace and our history at Rackspace, the culture was probably our number one competitive factor. And what I mean by that, we were hiring people off the street, had worked at Gap, had been, coming straight out of college, had no experience as technical support staff. Mm. And we were bringing them on board and we were training them and changing their lives. And one of the things we learned is, especially if you're in a customer support environment. So back, think about what we did. We were helping people, especially in the early days of the e-commerce world, keep their applications up and running. And we differentiated based on support, which is very different at the time than what you saw from our competitors, which was, it was about speeds and feeds. They wanted to say we had the latest Blade server and our bandwidth looks like this or whatever. But if your application didn't work, it wasn't really their problem. We took a different approach, which is you shouldn't even care what the hardware is. We're just going to make sure your application is up and running with you and be a great partner. And what we discovered is if you have happy employees, that leads to them to put out their best for their customers. And if the customers are happy, guess what? The employees feel better. And it's just a really virtuous loop, right? And also, again, I don't want people to come to a place that they hate. I mean, life is short. You want people to volunteer to give their best, and you're only going to get their best if the culture is important. And culture is different everywhere. They all have different approaches. But the way I always think about it is, if I go into a company and they don't have a defined culture and a mission of some sort that I can see that everyone's sort of rallied around, then I think that's a bad sign. And culture comes in different forms. You go to Google because you're going to work on the best technical problems. We had a company called Fix, which sold to Rockwell Automation. They were in the maintenance professional space. So these are the teams that have to work in factories, turning screws, oiling things, tracking parts, doing all that kind of stuff. And what they learned was their customer base were actually very much interested in the outdoors and very much interested in environmental protection. And so they kind of oriented the company around that and attracted employees that were interested in that. So you had this really interesting synergy between the employees and the customers as well. And I just use that as an example of fixing that alignment really matters. And you just get great results out of people when they want to come to work, work hard, and they feel personally attached to what you're doing. By the way, that's really hard to do in the world of virtual now. It's one of those things where I'm not as much, I don't think it's because of my age, but I'm not as much of a fan of the virtual company, because I think it's hard to establish culture when people are not together. And I think remoteness, unfortunately, establishes distrust. When people are not around each other, I think you get natural levels of distrust, which are hard to overcome.
Interesting. Have you seen any really appealing solutions to overcome remote work?
A lot of our companies are more remote now. And I say, if you're going to do that, you got to establish the budget to really make sure y'all are getting together regularly. But my preference would be for companies, and most of our companies do it this way, is you can not really have a dedicated be in the office. But what I'd love it is if you hire your employees in the same region, right? Mm-hmm. So don't decide they can work wherever they want, but decide hey, we're based in Phoenix, Arizona. I want everyone to be within an hour's drive of Phoenix, so that when we want to get together, we can get together. Because then it sometimes becomes a cost issue, right? You can't fly everyone in from around the country, 10 sure. times a year, but if everyone's within an hour drive, you can probably do it at least once every couple of weeks and get them together. Yep. So we try hard to get people to operate that way. And there are benefits to being remote. So I won't knock all those down, but culture definitely takes a hit. Zero doubt about that. Humans need to be together to establish culture.
Very true. I agree. There's definitely benefits, but FaceTime, proximity, breaking bread, I mean, they're invaluable. I miss it to a degree, and in our case, we're predominantly remote, but to your point, we try to get together on a regular basis, just because we enjoy each other's company. We love working together, but you're right. I mean, it's you can't make up for that office. Jim, great podcast. One of the questions I love to wrap up with, if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
What stage? How young?
your call. We've had some guests who've been like, all right, hey, 8-year old self.
Well, you know, it's funny. I do a bunch of stuff at University of Texas. And last week I had to talk to two groups, one at the business school, one at the undergrad school. And number one thing I always tell them is, first of all, you know, you can make all the mistakes you want in your 20s. You know, don't try to be perfect like I was. And in fact, that in some ways I would argue, while there were great benefits to it, probably took me off what my purpose was. Get out there and try stuff. And the second thing is, don't panic. You know, I mentor so many people and they get so worked up about, am I on the right track? Am I doing the right thing? And, you know, I've made some fatal mistake and I just try to give them stories about that's not the case. I was that person, you know, I was definitely in that mode. And then now as I've gotten older, I have my kids, I've got my oldest just turned 16. I talk to him a lot. And I've said to him, like, you know, life is about people and experiences. The only memory that's going to exist of you when you're gone is the people that you were with. That memory is even stronger when you've had really good shared experiences with them. So yeah. Like I think about Rackspace as an example. You know, when I was there, it was a few dozen people at the beginning and, you know, to thousands at the end. But they're all people that I have really fond memories of, and vice versa. And so work really hard to help my kids understand all that. One of the things also I tell people is the good news is the world has changed from where you and I graduated college. And there definitely is not as much of a straight line path. There's a lot more flexibility to go and do different things. And I think that's tremendous. So yeah, I would tell myself to relax and make more mistakes and do all that kind of stuff early and don't panic about it.
I love framing it as making mistakes. Because you know, sometimes too, I think people don't start things out of fear of failure. Yeah. And maybe they don't necessarily appreciate that here in the US that we have a culture that allows people to fail. And it's not the case in every country. So take advantage of it. Because you don't know what you don't know.
Well, when you get to be our age too, it's funny, and you sit around and talk to people, we don't talk about our successes. When I sit down and talk about Rackspace with my friends, we all talk about, you remember that time this happened? I'm like, oh, yeah. I remember we made that mistake. And I say, those memories are great because they were pivotal moments and always something good comes out of them. And they're the things you laugh about. Of course, you celebrate. But later in life, I found myself looking back on all the things I did wrong and think, wow, that was actually fun. Because yeah, I learned something.
100%. You know, I heard someone give an analysis on this habit. I do the same thing, and they said it's a great indication that you're maturing because you recognize that things didn't go as planned, and so hey, it means you're evolving in the right direction. Jim, great podcast. Thank you. If there are any of our listeners who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Jim@BuildGroup.com.
Awesome. Jim Curry, co-founder and CEO of Build Group. Jim, thanks so much for being a guest on the podcast. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Christian. This was fun.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. This is another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Thank you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.